Marcus and Ray here to welcome a new sponsor to the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll podcast, 1CBD.
Check them out at 1CBD.com. That's 1CBD.com. And you can search 1CBD on social media and find them there as well. Ty, who is one of the founders of 1CBD, created this company because of his own personal health and medical issues. And he has been working very hard to try to ease the pains and the discomforts and some of the side effects that go with and are associated with his health issues. And he knows that CBD is one of those products that can really help him with his health issues.
And from that point of view, Ty consciously created a product that has 100% organic sources. They use holistic removal of all the THC, selecting the best strains, and employing independent lab testing. All these things are important because if you're going to use CBD and put something in your body, you want to make sure it's of the highest quality.
1CBD is also halal and kosher compliant. And again, get more information about Ty, his story, about the products 1CBD at their website, 1CBD.com.
It's 1CBD, so you can live your best life.
Check, 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 check.
Yeah, check. We're on, right?
We're on and rolling.
I'm Ray Coop.
I'm Marcus in the Darkest.
And this week on the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll, we want to go back to one of our earliest episodes before we were with Pantheon Podcast and repeat it because we feel it's one of our best early episodes.
We had a lot of fun laying the foundation for punk rock.
The term proto-punk really wasn't used back in those days. It's something that's come around to describe this era of type of music years and years later.
How was it classified back then? Because this was...
Everything wasn't put in little cubby holes. Everything was just kind of like rock or rock and roll, and it had all had different feels and origins and stuff. A lot of the dividing it up into this camp and that camp didn't happen until much later. People just liked it or they didn't, right? Well,
yeah.
This is about a music that a lot of people liked and set the wheels in motion towards the explosion of punk that we would talk about in a future episode here on the podcast. So we wanted to just jump in and say hi, and we didn't have a sponsor when we did this, so we'll thank Crooked Eye in advance and let them play us in on this special episode.
It's proto-punk on the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll.
You know, Marcus, with life on hold, our friends at Crooked Eye Brewery want everyone to stay safe so that we can all get through this. And I know you're washing your hands a lot, right?
I am definitely keeping as clean as I can be, washing my hands, using safe distancing. And, Ray, you know, they also want you to know over at Crooked Eye that you can bring your growler to the brewery on Montgomery Avenue in Hatboro for a refill.
Yes, as long as this thing goes on and they have beer, you can do that. Yeah, the boys have been busy, right?
They have been very, very busy.
Hey, Marcus, I learned something about our buddies at Crooked Eye during the last week or so.
What's that?
We always thank Paul and the gang there at the brewery, but I found out that a lot of people call Paul Mulheron Pete.
What?
So do we thank Paul and Pete and Jeff for their continued support and keeping things going there at the brewery?
I think we do, and we want you to keep up on the latest developments at Crooked Eye on their social media sites as well as at CrookedEyeBrewery.com.
You know, that's where I learned the Pete thing was on their social media. So, see, you do learn stuff. And soon they'll be pouring at Jamie's House of Music in Lansdowne, PA. I saw a picture of the bar. It's looking good. They'll be down near you, Marcus.
Yeah, that's just a hop, skip, and a jump from where we live, so I will definitely be grabbing some Crooked Eye over in Lansdowne for sure. But first, folks, if you're going to go out, make sure you wash your hands and keep your distance.
And let's shut this virus down. It's cutting into my drinking time. Welcome to episode 6 of the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll. I'm Ray Coob, along with
Marcus in the Darkest. How are you, dude?
Dude, I'm ready to talk about punk rock roots.
Me too.
We've been talking a lot in our first few episodes about British stuff, but there was a lot of stuff going on in America in the mid-60s. I guess people would say that a lot of what we want to talk about today are the roots of punk rock,
yeah,
which came around and developed in this, more in the late 60s and 70s. But there in the mid-60s, what later became known as proto-punk, I guess you'd say the nasty neighbor of garage band rock, right?
Yeah, definitely the nasty neighbor of garage band rock, but a major influence on all of the punk sound that we heard in the 70s and 80s,
and
even the late
here,
60s and here
still
today.
Here, yeah, it's still today. It is the Imbalance History of Rock and Roll podcast, and we want to thank some friends who help us out on the way in and on the way out. You hear our good friend Rick DeFonso from his new album, Instrumental. The mental part is the emphasis there, and you can check out rickdefonso.com to find out how you can get it for yourself. He's done so much great music through the years, and this is what he's been working on, he told me so. And we'll, at some point we'll get into the roots of Philly rock, too, which DeFonso was a part of.
I wonder if he'll come in and chat with us about it.
Well, he's in Florida. If we can get him out of Florida, that'd be a good
We can get him on the horn with somebody else in the
true.
Studio
That's
as well.
True. Look, rock and roll. It's just like real human history. We're learning stuff already as we've started this podcast. We're only 6 episodes in starting today, and we want it to be as interactive as possible. So we've got a couple ways that you can be in touch with us through email, imbalancedhistory@gmail.com, or on Facebook. And we have a lot of friends on Facebook who we need to encourage more of them to come and listen to the podcast.
Absolutely.
It's Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll on Facebook, so check that out. So, when it comes to proto-punk and the American reaction to British invasions, wave 1 and 2 and probably part of wave 3 there in the mid-60s, there's a few cities that really show the ugly side of the American rock and roll response. And let's talk about those, I guess, to get things started. We can go through and talk about that.
We have Detroit, we have L.A., we have New York.
Yeah, but there were other things going on, too, we found out when we started really looking into it. San Francisco had an ugly little underbelly.
Chicago had a little bit.
Yeah, and also, not to be too surprising, a band that we actually thought, when we started looking around, we thought they were from L.A. They turned out to be from Tacoma. Very close to the Northwest ground zero for what happened there much later into the 80s. So.
Can't wait to talk about all that.
Well, when you look around New York, I think most of us, and this includes me, maybe it's when I was growing up, we tended to see the scene in full blossom in New York, you know, late 60s and into the 70s. But there in 1965, 66, there were a bunch of art guys getting together, a guy named John Cale, Lou Reed,
who was very pissed off at that point, different from him in the 50s.
We were talking about that before the podcast. Yeah, well, I think a lot of people went through that period of time when they were finding and the angry side in America. There was a lot going on in the country.
True.
Part of it was a reaction to that. But they put together a little troupe called the Velvet Underground.
Yeah.
And
With an art guy.
Yeah, in a way, because Andy Warhol, his whole factory scene was all kind of happening in and around that. They were mm-hmm. caught up in that. And they had some initial fits and starts and ended up with Mo Tucker on drums, who was probably the most badass woman behind a kit. Not only that, she played unconventionally. You know, she'd like to stand up and hit the shit out of things. It was this whole art scene band. Even that first album, we talked about that.
Yeah.
With the big banana, mm-hmm. you know, Warhol.
The peel off banana.
Yeah, with Warhol. Was it a peel off?
Some copies were.
Really?
Yeah.
I never saw one of those. And the fact that Nico was on the record
yes.
was a Warhol influence. I don't know if you know that. He kind of pushed her into the fold, and she did 3 songs on that record. And they later found their legs on their own. And as they move forward as a band into the 70s, they really hit their stride. And, you know, the big songs that everybody remembers Velvet's from, you know. There at the beginning, though, it wasn't so good. There was a trip, a slip and a fumble, and the record got shoveled off to the side, didn't really get much attention at first, but it got a lot of fans. I think I got to go back. Maybe I can find out if we take a break in the middle of this whole thing. There's somebody made the quote, not everybody bought that first Velvet's record, but everyone who bought it formed a fucking band.
That's pretty interesting.
That's why it's such an influential thing and why it set off so many bombs.
Now, we've seen a lot of those types of albums in our days since that Velvet Underground album, and it'll be fun to maybe delve into that subject as well, but that album is so important, and you hear many musicians claim it as a major influence, especially from about 5-6 years afterwards.
That's what happened. All those bands were getting interviewed in the major press and local press, and they were all citing the Velvets and that record and the continued momentum they had. And then they stumbled, and Lou fell out as a solo guy, and Cale went on to do other things. But they set off an explosion in New York that led to the Dolls and Richard Hell and the Ramones, you know, and everything that happened right there on the Lower East Side, a lot of it happened because of what was happening then.
Now, do you think that Velvet Underground album also impacted cities like Cleveland and Detroit and L.A.?
I don't know.
Or do you think it was their own, like, blue-collar sound or their own rebellion against the Hollywood sound?
I think that that's part of it, and that's part of what was going on probably in L.A.
The surf rock.
In Detroit, it was a kick out the jams. It was
they were
mentality
blue-collar
we're
as
not
hell.
Going to take this.
Yes.
Yeah, blue-collar as hell, everybody working their ass off just to make a living.
Yep.
Right there in the Detroit area. And what happened there with them and the MC5? Can't forget the MC5.
No way. The MC5, huge. Without the MC5, we wouldn't. We needed the MC5 to have the Stooges.
All right. I got to jump back to New York because I forgot a couple bands from New York.
All right. Let's
talk about
these
bands.
Before
we go forward on the Stooges and everything, Iggy. The other bands that really kind of impacted it in New York, they didn't really. I wouldn't even say that they were a hit band, but everybody knows of the Fugs.
Yeah.
Now, they were on the Lower East Side, which is where, it's what made me think of it. It's where all the shit started down there, but in the area where all the great clubs were and cheap rents and a bunch of, you know, crazy kids wanting to live in the city.
It's funny because that's a big Jewish neighborhood, Orthodox Jewish neighborhood and business neighborhood as well.
I did not know that.
Yeah, there's like the Lower East Side. I know when I was a kid in the 80s and 90s, that's where a lot of the Jewish merchants were.
They were living side by side with the freaks, you know?
That's awesome.
Now, in the Bronx, there was a band called the Blues Magoos who a lot more people heard of. They had the big hit that was number 5 in the U.S. We Ain't Got Nothing Yet, you know?
Yeah.
This is where we would drop in a snippet if we could. They were on TV. They actually got out there. They were on Bandstand, Where the Action Is.
So they came down to Philadelphia to perform on Bandstand.
I guess that they did.
They did.
I might even remember seeing that one. They once were on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, which was pretty edgy for the time.
That
for
was
network
super
TV.
Edgy.
But they were on there at a time, and the thing is, the Blues Magoos became more well-known, I guess, as a psychedelic band, but they had a huge influence, and they also broke down some of those barriers. They were also, check this out, this is one of those things that makes your mind go, what? They were once on the Kraft Music Hall, hosted by Jack Benny.
What?
So, you know, they continued to record, and they had, you know, like everybody, they fell into the psychedelic vat that everybody was lumped into. Even though their roots were a little more edgy than that.
That's so funny. I mean, and it's funny you mentioned that they were on Dick Clark's American Bandstand because Question Mark and the Mysterians also performed on American Bandstand as well. And it was kind of funny to see them, who were so different than the rest of the sound that they were playing at that time.
Right.
But it was funny because they were kind of like, we're maybe a little out of place here.
I noticed that with a few artists, and especially I think a lot of them were uncomfortable with the policy of having to lip sync to the songs. You know, they couldn't even sing live. I remember a few artists changing that, but let's not get off the subject.
Did you get down here to see it live when you were a kid?
No.
God, okay, I was just wondering if you got to see Bandstand when you were a young one. All righty, just asking.
You know what we can do? Let's stick to our original plan, and we'll come back to Detroit because it's along the journey here.
Absolutely.
In L.A., you mentioned it earlier. You know, there was kind of a discontent against the plastic Hollywood facade.
There's always been that, it
and
seems.
But with music and culture and everything, it was, L.A. was ripe for this because there were a lot of kids. And we were talking about a band called The Seeds. And, you know, they were a regional hit. And then they kind of had a hit. Their song Pushing Too Hard got them on top 40. That's where I first heard them. And what most people remember them was in 66.
Whoa.
And then they kind of went back to being regional favorites, like California favorites. So they could play and tour and get airplay regionally, but they never really broke out the way a lot of bands wanted to. But they broke up in 1969 at their creative peak and continued to influence the future generations of L.A. bands.
You see a lot of these almost, it seems like these almost flash in the pan phases of music produce some of the biggest influences, which is crazy because we listed down some of the influences of the Seeds or people who have claimed that we would know that claim the Seeds as an influence, like Pere Ubu, Garbage, yeah. The Ramones, Johnny Thunders, Alex Chilton. I do want to talk about him sometime. The Bangles, Frank Zappa. Seriously.
Well, it's funny that Frank, he would just throw shit into everything. And he'd take a little Pushing Too Hard, and I'm going to put it in the middle of this song, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But also, you know, other bands, too. You know, there was Smashing Pumpkins cited them as an influence. And then, you know, there was...
Alarm Clock.
But you had it. But see, now the psychedelic goop, right? Yeah. It was all in, and it was all in pop radio and pop music and on the radio, AM radio and all that stuff. You know, you had the Strawberry Alarm Clock. And you had a bit, but you had bands like Love and the Electric Prunes that came out of the beginning of that whole thing. And then there's a band, we were talking about doing this, and we were talking about the bands that we would look at and bring in. And one of them was the Standells. And I always, because of the song Dirty Water, always, always thought that they were from Boston. I thought, wow, how about this? They're from L.A.
That is weird that they're playing that on the Boston, that the Boston Red Sox and the Boston Bruins play that every time they win.
Well, that's what it's become, kind of a tradition, but, you know. But they later, they're cited by the Ramones and the Sex Pistols as an influence. They were the epitome of successful garage rock. And it was a big hit for them for a long time, and they kind of rode the wave, and then the wave went away and Dirty Water remained. And then sports teams, you know, as soon as a sports team adopts one of your songs, it's going to go evergreen pretty much. They're one of those groups that they had a lot of changing members. Dick Dodd came in. People know him. He was a former Mouseketeer, so people kind of recognized him. And they also had Dewey Martin. After they did Dirty Water, Dewey Martin, who later was in Buffalo Springfield, was in there. So they were, that's where they kind of crossed paths in family trees with a couple things there. But they had an influence on people. They were even goofy enough to be on the Munsters. That's how acceptable the Standells were at some
that's
point.
Awesome.
I think I remember that. Come On and Ringo was the song they performed. So, you know, that's the kind of influence that they had, and they were in that scene. So they got to be in a movie called Ride on Sunset Strip. It seemed perfect, so... but being from L.A. and now identified with Boston, they are the Standells.
That's pretty crazy. And the fact that the Sex Pistols claim them as an influence as well, which is funny because that's so something you wouldn't expect Johnny Rotten to say, because Johnny Rotten's kind of a whatever you think. He's a dick. And he's a dick to be a dick, I guess you would say, just for the sake of being a dick, because he's good at it.
On our Facebook page, we posted the video. It's an argument between
him and Marky Ramone.
Yeah, Marky Ramone. And them just, oh, it's open season between factions of punk rock. If you've never seen it, go check that out.
It's fantastic.
On Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll on Facebook. Marcus, I got to tell you, Maurice is pretty excited about our new sponsor, AdamandEve.com.
Why is that?
Well, she likes sexy time. She likes the stuff they have on there, all the different items and lingerie, things, the various items that people might need in intimate moments. And she likes to save 50% off, and that's what people can do right now if they enter a special code from us at AdamandEve.com.
50% off? What could that code be?
It's very simple. The letters RNRHIST. It's like it's almost our name. RNRHIST at AdamandEve.com.
You know what's really cool about that, Ray?
Tell me, my friend.
You get free stuff. A whole lot of it. 10 items worth of free stuff.
And free shipping.
10 free items and free shipping. That is over the top sexy. But what are those free items?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Marcus, because There's a sexy item for him, a special gift for her, and a third item you'll both enjoy, plus those six spicy movies. And check it out. You get 50% off your order at checkout. And all the goodies.
That's an unbelievable deal. All you got to do is use the code RNRHIST. That's RNRHIST at AdamandEve.com.
So the next band is the band we wanted to talk about. We thought they were from L.A. And then I started looking, and there's right there, maybe
Tacoma, Washington.
Tacoma, Washington is very close, not too far from Seattle. The band, the Sonics. They're cited as influences by Nirvana, Springsteen, The Fall, and others.
Mudhoney.
Yeah, and then you get into that, like we were talking about, that dirty sound in Seattle. You can draw some of the roots of it back to the Sonics, and it was Mudhoney was on that edge, and a lot of the other bands that that came up later in the 80s and into the 90s in Seattle. I guess you could find a little bit of a I don't know if it's a family tree as much as it is, you know, the neighborhood and having a huge influence, because they were very influential on people who weren't from there.
Yep. And one of the things that I find really impressive is how people found out about this music that wasn't maybe as mainstream but still big, and they were able to take it, be influenced by it, and then hold on to it. Whereas today we have such an easier access. And even since the 80s it was easy. I mean, through all the little rags that we would read, like Trouser right. Press or Hard and Fast or any of those. I mean, we would find new music. Radio was also a great place
yes.
at that time as well.
Now, going back to the proto-punk initial era in 65 and 66, it was still all AM. But Top 40 was a lot more open to the new sounds.
Okay.
You know, the hip sounds.
Okay. See, that's right before I was even born.
I know.
So I don't remember radio from that time period.
Here's something I've been thinking about.
Okay.
I think because we have about 9-10 years between us, we have just the right gap to be complimentary on this podcast. Oh, by the way, it is the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll podcast. And if you wonder why, it's because things like that. So, hey, you know what I thought was also very interesting about the Sonics was that the White Stripes named them as one of the bands that had a big influence on me. They called them the epitome of 60s punk. So Jack's no slouch, you know.
Dude, Jack might be the most influential rock and roll musician of the last 20 years.
He is an incredible gift.
He is very important.
I await every one of his recorded utterings with great intent.
I know. I can't wait for the new Rockin' Tours record, which is just going to be filthy and dirty. The first two songs are nice and delicious and just filthy, and I can't wait to hear the rest of the record. Getting back to it, Kurt Cobain of Nirvana cites this band as an influence. I'm sure then that would include the...
What's the quote I have here? The Sonics recorded very, very cheaply on a two-track. You know, they just used one microphone over the drums, and they got most amazing drum sound I ever heard. Still to this day, it's still my favorite drum sound. It sounds like he's hitting harder than anyone I've ever known.
That's a great quote.
That's so Cobain, man.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting, though, to see the Bruce Springsteen also pipe up about the band. You know, he had some pretty interesting influences, especially as L.A. became part of his life, or the West Coast became part of his life.
Oh, yeah.
In L.A., there was this band. They were called the Music Machine when everybody kind of heard of them. They had a song, Talk Talk, that was influential. Had a lot of people talking about it, no pun intended. Got them onto the underground radio and started taking things in that direction. And here's the interesting thing about it. Their bass player was Keith Olsen, young Keith Olsen, who would later go on to form Pogo Productions and become one of the great producers of the 70s and 80s and all that.
Heading north up to San Francisco from L.A. in the 70s and 80s, the punk scene between the two were so different. San Francisco was a lot more, I would say, outright in-your-face political, whereas L.A. might have been a little more subtly political. But in the early days, you had bands and the psychedelia scene. You had Haight Ashbury. You had all this crazy stuff happening up there.
And the hate was happening well before 1967 when the Summer of Love was in play.
Oh, yeah.
But running, like, parallel to the Beats and the Folkies, because it was really a folk scene that evolved, the electric
Yeah.
As far as the music, you know, if you look at a lot of the bands, there was sometimes bands that had a heavy acoustic sound. As they're moving forward, there's also this thing running parallel.
But you also, with that scene in the 60s, didn't you have bands like Journey who were a jazz band? You had Santana who was doing a lot more jazz and not really well known at that time.
Carlos and that was brand new to the world in 1969.
Okay, he was 69, so he was later.
Everything that started happening in 66 and 67 just snowballed and grew and grew and grew. What was going on then was not that much, but there was this band called the Blue Cheer, another garage band that had an attitude. You know, they played a lot in the 60s into the 70s, and they had some hits. They were known as a psychedelic blues band because I guess blue was in their name, but they got lumped in with all the psychedelia and stuff. But then they started having some hit records, the biggest of which was their cover of Summertime Blues.
Whoa.
And it was everywhere. It became one of those songs that stations would use every summer. They may play it a little while as an oldie, you know, because it was from last year. But the Summertime Blues, of course, that led to The Who hearing it, Eddie Cochran's original version, the whole nine yards. But that set off a little bit of an explosion out of San Francisco that added them to the mix. And now we come full circle back to Detroit, where, you know, the blue-collar, hard-working Ashton Brothers and their friend Jim, Dave Alexander, they all pull together. They start playing in this band called the Stooges because they're stupid as fuck. You know what I mean? They were just in Detroit. Years later, you know how, like, Detroit kind of looked at Eminem and his gang when they were all, like, freestyle battles in the alley and all that stuff?
Yeah.
A bunch
Eight
of
Mile?
Dumbass, you know, the 8 Mile story, but that whole scene. That's how Detroit, the Motowns and all the R&B favorites and stuff, the Pops, these guys were the assholes of the scene.
Okay.
Nobody wanted to talk to them. Nobody wanted to play. They found each other, and they started something that still reverberates today.
Now, Funhouse.
This is where you see a little bit of cross-correlation. When they get around, we'll talk more about before this, but when they get around to making that first Stooges record, produced by John Cale of the Velvet Underground.
Yep.
Ta-da!
Yeah.
Found that one.
Boom.
They started in Ann Arbor, and it was just those guys, and they played this style of rock and roll. I don't think the DJs knew what the hell to do with it. And eventually, the underground radio world started to embrace them a little bit. By then, things had changed, and they were starting to think about breaking up, I guess. Really, you had two great records out of the chute in 69 with the Stooges and Funhouse in 70.
I still have my early pressing of Funhouse.
Hold on to that.
Oh, I'm never letting that baby go. That album is fantastic. My parents used to shit when I would play it. They would get so pissed. Oh, they would get so fucking pissed.
Well, because it gave an attitude. That's
pissed. It was great. My mom especially. My dad was like, I kind of get what you're going through. But mom was like, uh-uh-uh.
So the Stooges, they have a couple big records, including the one that drove your mama crazy. And then they break up.
Yep.
And they figure it out, and they get back together. A couple years later, they do Raw Power,
where
the production values are better.
Mm-hmm.
Records sound really good.
Yep.
And then they break up again in 74.
And then, James Williamson and Iggy Pop did that Stooges record together, and it was just the two of them without anybody else in the band, which was okay. It had some good music, but it wasn't punk. It was more refined.
And then guys started dying, and it really hit by then. It was Iggy. Iggy had created a persona.
Mm-hmm.
He had, in the way that Bowie created a persona.
Well, he was also part of that Berlin heroin scene in 76. Nick Cave was part of the birthday party, and that was part of it.
Well,
were all fucking crazy in that time period.
Jim was out of control. Bowie was out of control.
Oh, Bowie was fucking nuts
so
at that time.
So what they did was they decided Bowie took him under his wing and said, you know, Ig, come with me. I'm going to Berlin. We're going to work on it. We're going to do Station to Station.
Mm-hmm.
So come hang with me. And he just hung out with them. And they kind of worked through a lot of that, their shit. They figured it out. And they got themselves in a much better place at that time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they were together all through that.
I mean, Jesus. And then, that's where they wrote China Girl in that time period, I think. Or right after that.
Well, the Stooges eventually got their turn. And they got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2010.
So late.
I know.
They should have been in one of the first classes.
Come on. I want to be your dog.
Dude.
The concept of I want to be your dog
alone.
That
song.
So anyway, They got the same treatment that a lot of innovators got through the years. The critics, the big names and the little ones all slapped them around, except for one guy.
Who was it?
Lester Bangs. He was their savior. He would write great things about them and make sure that the people who thought like they thought and thought like he thought would get their exposure because they were getting shit on by the big guys.
Man. Lester Bangs, Bowie, Iggy. Listen to this. This is just crazy, all these ties. Nick Cave threw the birthday party, who was doing the heroin rock. He left Australia to go to Berlin at the same time they did.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and they, I can't wait till we do a page or an episode about Nick Cage. I have the hugest boner for that dude. Man. Love Nick Cave.
Bromance.
Totally bromance, man. He's totally amazing. Podcast. And he's got a new album coming out in 2019, which I'm stoked about.
Cool.
But then, okay, so we've been talking about the Stooges, but before them is a band who, without this band, there would be no Stooges.
I think you could make a case for that, because not only did they come before, but they opened up and helped to create a scene that the Stooges were able to plug into as far as gigs and what was going on in the Detroit area. From Lincoln Park, Michigan, I give you MC5. Kick out the jams, motherfucker. They were one of the first bands that everybody went, well, we'll never play that record on the radio because of that. Eventually people edited it out. Some people did because it was too good not to play.
And they were as crazy as they were loaded.
Well, Fred Sonic Smith, I guess maybe he was the more grounded one, but he was pretty wild too. I mean, they had attitude coming out. First thing in the morning, man, before coffee, they had attitude. Wayne Kramer, are you kidding me? The guy, you're talking about crazy, man.
Dude ended up in jail for a while.
I know.
Big drug deal, if I'm not mistaken.
He was selling cocaine to undercover cops and went to prison for 2 years. Guess who he met in prison?
Who?
Charlie Parker's guy, Red Rodney.
What?
You ever saw the movie Bird?
Yes, Charlie.
And they played together when they were in prison together, like the Blues Brothers, for crying out loud. But check it out. Now, there's a connection to John Lennon here, and this is how it comes together. Okay, you know who John Sinclair was? He was their manager.
Yeah.
But he's also the founder of the White Party.
The White Panther Party, which was a radical left-wing white
party.
Yes,
it was. And later, John Landau stepped in. But John Sinclair was their manager up until he got popped for pot possession in Toronto, I think. And they were going to put him away. And that's when Lennon came in and, you know, did the concert, the Free John Sinclair and all that stuff. So up in Toronto. And then John Landau became their manager. It never seemed to really all come together. They had an insane cult following, similar to the Velvets, where not everybody bought their record, but everybody who did formed a band kind of a vibe. And I think that's a theme in a lot of this here.
They were dirty. They were dirty fucking rock and roll. They took that New York sound and made it filthy. They were just a filthy version of it. And I love that about them. And they didn't give a fuck. No. They were like, fuck it. Hey, we're dirty.
Listen. This is where the streams cross, though.
Yeah.
Okay, Kramer gets out of prison after his cocaine possession.
Yeah. Right?
Goes to New York, teams up with Johnny Thunders, form a band called Gang War. So, you know, we're talking about later in the 70s, but here's the connections back to this proto-punk era moving forward. He was a wacky dude. He was on the Uncle Floyd show, for Christ's sake. I saw that. And he was the original guitarist in Was Not Was. It's one of those things.
Wayne Kramer, yeah.
That
is the weirdest thing, because I remember hearing them on alternative college radio.
I know. It's like finding out that John McLaughlin thing on the Yardbirds episode last week, right? Yeah. It's like, what?
Exactly.
You learn all kinds of shit, I'll tell you that. Anyway, but and he was involved with that, and he later signed with Beck Gurewitz, Epitaph Records, and did some records there, and, you know, continue to work with David was, while Don was busy with the Stones, I guess. But it's just really interesting to see all these things come together when you see the way that things start all out there in different cities and different parts of the country, mm-hmm. how they all come together and cross-pollinate, mm-hmm.
Cross-breed, cross-pollinate. And
you know, John Cale coming through and producing for the Stooges, things like that, those connections, you didn't see that much of that.
Okay.
The scene stuff, other than the beats.
Okay.
You know, after the beats. It was the beginning of rock and roll, having the scenes here, there, and everywhere, and then they all started connecting.
Now, were bands like the MC5 and the Standells and all of them touring and playing small places with some of these bands in that time period?
I don't know.
Because I've been trying to look up and see if I've been looking to see if there were any that I could find, and I couldn't find any dates with any of these bands together. Setlist doesn't have them, which I don't expect, but you would expect some old like microfilm or microfiche rags, which might have that stuff on it, maybe has been found or printed by hardcore researchers.
Some realistic timeline here.
Yep.
65?
Yes.
I was like 7. So, you know, I was hearing this stuff like everybody else on the radio. That's why some of this stuff stuck in my brain. That's why some of it's still relevant to a lot of people now.
Yeah.
But the biggest thing is what we've been talking about. Look at the picture we're painting of the influence of what was happening in America pre-67.
That's true.
Post-Beatles, 65 and 66, all this amazing music. And another episode, we've got to talk about the bigger picture, and we can bring back some of our favorites from this one and talk about the garage band phenomena of America.
Yeah.
And how many bands, how many of those bands that bought the Velvet Underground records and the MC5 records ended up in garages?
No kidding.
And then on Warner Brothers and Columbia and, you know, what have you.
I bet if we read all the books that they wrote, we'd find a lot of them in there.
We're just getting started. We have unlimited ability to count episodes.
Yeah. We're going to need a research team eventually.
Rick Goob here along with my buddy. I am the Doc. He is Marcus in the Darkest. And this is the Imbalance History of Rock and Roll podcast. I tell you what, man, we're having fun with this.
Yes,
and
we are.
A lot of people are giving us some great input. And we thank you for tuning in. And thank you for being part of it by emailing us at our Gmail account. It's imbalancehistory@gmail.com. Or where can they find us on social media?
On Facebook, Imbalance History of Rock and Roll. Like the page. Listen to the podcast. Comment. Get involved.
It is a production of Dark Duck Media. Ray Coob and Marcus in the Darkest. For episode number 6, American Proto-Punk, it is the Imbalanced History
of Rock and Roll.